Welcome to the Conference for Women Teleclass, Make It Happen, Your Idea, Vision, Dream. We are thrilled today to bring you conference speaker Nilufer Merchant. Nilufer is an author, a widely respected business thinker, and a champion for the quote-unquote nobodies in the room. Over the course of her career, she's been an administrative assistant, a CEO. She's launched over 100 products, netting $18 billion in sales, and has held executive positions everywhere from early internet startups to Fortune 500 companies like Apple and Autodesk. Lately, she's been thinking and writing about the transformative effect technology has had on traditional hierarchical power structures, especially in the marketplace of ideas. Her latest book, The Power of Onlyness, examines the ways in which we can now create supportive communities around our ideas, rather than trying to simply blend in or face dismissal or rejection by those who don't want to hear us. Nilufer, can you take us through the idea of onlyness?
Oh my gosh. So onlyness is a term I coined back in 2011, 2012. I was really using it as a word to name that each of us stands in a spot in the world only you stand in, a function of your distinct history and experiences, visions and hopes. And the reason I wanted a new word is because so many other words that are used to define true originality don't take account of bias and how much we all face bias. So let me just take kind of a couple stories that I've of my own life and then why I researched the book and how people can actually apply this concept in their life. So I guess I would start with the most personal of stories that I've ever shared. And I start the book, in fact, with the story, which surprised me. But it was the most, like, I was trying to think, when did I come to clarity in my own life that sometimes the reason we're not heard is not because we're not speaking, not because of something we're not doing well, but because of the context we're in. And when I was 18 years old, I experienced that in a pretty harsh and dramatic way. I was raised in America since I was 4 and a half, and yet very much understood that my role as part of an Indian traditional family was to, using air quotes, marry well, right, to help provide for my mother, make sure she got a house, those kinds of things. And so one day I came home from community college, which is what I was doing during the day, and the house, I could actually smell first that people were in the house by smelling this aroma of biryani from the driveway, which is like this buttery chicken rice dish. And then I could hear my aunties and uncles, and it was clear they were celebrating something, and it wasn't until I walked in that I knew that my arranged marriage had been settled. And I went to my uncle, who had been helping with the negotiations since my father was out of the picture, and asked him this one question, which was the one thing I had asked from my family as part of this negotiation: can you please make sure that he knows, the future groom would know, that I wanted an education? It was something that in the Indian culture was typically reserved for the boys, but I had asked if I could have an education also. And my uncle had turned to me and said, well, you know, your mother won't let me negotiate that because what she really wants to do is make sure she gets a house. So I'm sorry, but I cannot help you. And I did wait until, you know, out of respect, I did wait until the aunties and uncles cleared out before I did this pretty dramatic thing. And it even surprised me. I took this used box from, you know, groceries, left over from grocery run, and put the few books I had just walked in with from community college in the box, and then walked down the hall, very much telling my mother that I was going to find out, you know, basically pack up and I'm leaving. And I said, I'm the product of this deal, and you cannot do this deal without me, so you have to at least ask the guy. And if he says no, that's one thing, but, you know, I really want you to ask on my behalf. And so I put an outfit in the box. Mind you, there was no toothbrush or anything because I didn't think this would last that long. I actually thought I would probably get stopped by the end of the driveway. So I was kind of surprised when I got to the end of the driveway and no one had stopped me, and I had to figure out, okay, well, what am I going to do next? And I ended up, as one does, I suppose, in high-stress situations, heading towards carbohydrates, and I ended up at this little place called a Winchell's Donut House. And one apple fritter and one donut hole later, I call home hoping the situation is resolved. Clearly not. My mother was not going to relent. And I was thinking, well, I've already made it this far. Like, I can't relent either. So I thought this would resolve in a day or maybe two. And it turned out, well, now 30 years have passed since that moment. And it was the first time where I really felt like I had articulated exactly what I wanted. I had leaned in proverbial modern language, and I wasn't getting what I needed. A couple of years later, I would go on and work at Apple and see a parallel situation. So here I am, an admin at Apple. I was working as part of a strategy team for a business leader. And at one point, they had said, we're going to get everyone together to brainstorm X, and you know, the specifics of which completely eluded me this many years later. But I remember being so excited to be able to contribute that I was being invited to the meeting, that the whole team was being invited. And I remember doing research. I remember taking notes. I remember thinking of ideas and then showing up, like, you know, kind of like ready to put my hand up in the air kind of thing. And it only took me a minute or two or three to realize no one was making any eye contact with me. That in that room, the people who mattered were the MBA types. And in later rooms, it would sometimes be related to the title of the people in the room. In later rooms, it would be the most dominant loud voices in the room. And so over the years of my career, what I just kept noticing was people are speaking up and trying to contribute, and yet there is a very specific set of voices that consistently wins and gets heard. And it wasn't until I saw Adam Galinsky's research, who's a professor out of Columbia Business School, to help me understand what the heck I had just witnessed, which is this. So Galinsky and McGee, who are two professors, research power, and they basically say that there's one significant reason that ideas get shot down. And it's that power and status act as self-reinforcing loops. So how much status a person has directly affects whether their idea is heard. So those with high power, you can totally picture meetings you've been in, right? Those with high power get receptivity to their early notions. They get help in developing those nascent ideas and the more complete ones, which of course leads to more results and even higher status. So it's, I call it the loop-de-loop cycle, right? Up and up they go. And equally true in this power dynamic is if you're a person of low status in an organization, and it could be because you're uncredentialed, like I was, young or old, woman, person of color in a mostly male culture, it can be a variety of factors, both demographics and things that sort of define whether or not someone has validity in that room. The likelihood is you'll get none of that early support. Instead, you'll be told some mix of it's too weird, it's too wild, and then the one that all my friends hear more often than not is that's too much. And women especially bear the brunt of it. And then if you're someone like me, a woman and person of color, you get it at a different magnitude. And so what I started to see in different work settings over 25 years, it's not because an idea was weighed and deemed unworthy, but because it came in the package of a person who is deemed powerless. And so I started to think that they're only seeing you by the silhouette, which denies the actual soul of the person standing right in front of you and that distinct value in which only we bring. And that turned out to be, the more I thought about that silhouette and soul tension, I realized that in all the books right now that are written on innovation, whether it's Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell or Adam Grant's Originals or Matt Ridley's Where Do Ideas Come From or Stephen B. Johnson's books on innovation, none of them actually address this bias question. And that really strikes me as, I don't know, ironic would probably be the word, but probably idiotic would be another word if I was being more expressive. But there's this irony of originality, which is some of us get seen for this distinctness of what we bring, and the rest of us are labeled as different. Some of us are seen as the subjects of our own story, able to navigate our own future, and some of us are seen as subjective or conditional to what other people wish. Some of us are seen for that thing that only we bring, and the rest of us are seen through the lens of otherness. And to be seen through the lens of another is to be subjectively evaluated by the bias or stereotype other people are then saying. You're getting compared to someone else instead of that which only you bring. So now you can kind of see why I came up with the term onlyness. I'm actually trying to say original apparently is not original enough. And there's a bunch of words that people use, unique. Unique is often used as a relative term. I would sometimes get called unique as a woman board member. And then they would say, well, Millifer, you have a unique opinion on this. And I was thinking, you know, the reason that I'm in this room, the reason I can add value is because I've shipped over 100 products. And that go-to-market experience is what's informing this next idea. The fact that I am a woman makes me one of 52% of the U.S. population. It's actually not that unique. And so I found words like originality or unique really not capturing that each and every single one of us has something to offer. And that's why this framework was so important. And then there's a second part of this, which is that bias is not just something that other people do to us, you know, that that corporate board member saying, hey, you know, you have a unique point of view. That's bias, right, from an outside point of view. But we can equally do it ourselves, to be ourselves. And we do it, I don't know, I think about it as being taking our own voice out of the picture. It's an unconscious act of conformity. And it turns out we don't do this because we want to. We do it because we're trying to figure out how to fit into our surroundings. In the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, belonging is the precondition to owning our ideas. Ideas are sort of at the top of that pyramid, and belonging turns out to be much more central. So when we're having to make trade-offs at work, we're actually making the trade-off to belong rather than claim our own ideas, not because we want to, but because we have to. And in fact, I found research done by Christy Smith, who was at Deloitte at the time, that found that 61% of people cover, quote-unquote, cover at work, hiding what makes them distinct, finding ways to fit in rather than bring forward their originality and their related fresh takes and ideas. And this, of course, applies to women and people of color and members of the LGBTQ community and so on, but it also includes white men. And that was the part that surprised me and yet doesn't surprise me, that 45% of white men do it too, because they're having to play to an alpha male type also. So it doesn't just affect women and people of color, which is a huge group, right? If you just kind of think about the math of that, that says 60% of us do it, and we're basically having to conform to a white male architecture, but it also affects those who are white males who don't actually, you know, fit into a particular stereotype. And so when I was thinking about how do we unlock onlyness, the thing that each of us can bring, because that's the key to all innovation, I started studying, in fact, in this book, I actually studied over 300 examples to get to the 20 stories I ended up writing in the book. And what I was trying to understand is it fixable? And then how is it fixable? So let me tell you the answer, and then let me tell you, I'll just share one story from the book that illustrates that point, and then kind of come back to it. And then, of course, we can do questions. So the answer is really this. That for us to overcome this bias of not being seen for ourselves, being seen by the silhouette of who we are, not the soul, we actually have to be with people who see us. So who surrounds us affects us, and that is true for our ideas too. And so that's the answer. Now let me just tell you one story that kind of illustrates it. There's actually 20, so I'm picking just one and using that to invite you into this idea. So Kimberly Bryant was a graduate of Vanderbilt University and an engineer. When she showed up to her second major job, her boss introduced her to her colleagues, her engineering colleagues, who she was so excited to come work with on a specific problem, and introduced her and said, with Kimberly Bryant, we get a twofer. And what he was pointing out in that moment was that Kimberly was both Black and a woman in tech. And so he was doing, you know, sort of the commentary was sort of on the diversity jackpot thing instead of actually pointing out what is so distinct to this person and the kinds of skills and capacities that she brings. So he was essentially otherizing her. And Kim, of course, makes advancements in her career but keeps getting blockaded. And at one point, her daughter is equally geeky and going to a summer coding camp and gets treated much the same as her. And Kimberly has this insight. Says, you know, it used to be like the mythology that she was told, turns out to actually be a lie, is that, you know, if one of us makes it through, it'll change things for the rest of us. And that turns out actually not to be true, because going back to that data, 61% of us cover, if one of us makes it through, we mostly have to figure out how to fit in, and so we can't actually change the situation. So Kim's daughter, Kai, is taking this coding class and getting treated like a novice when she's not. She comes home, she tells her mom this story, and her mom's thinking, oh my God, this has got to change. And she ends up arriving at this idea where she says, oh, I'll just get Kai and a couple of her friends around the kitchen table. So she borrows some old computers. She literally sketches out some curriculum. She's never done curriculum development in her life. Sketches out curriculum on the back of some piece of paper, and on weekends and evenings starts to teach these girls to code. And so literally other moms come and say, hey, I really love this. Can I borrow the curriculum? Other cities find out, you know, like people in different cities say, hey, can I borrow the curriculum? Can I borrow this idea? And people essentially pull this idea into the future. So here's Kim inside a traditional structure of tech and business getting told how she's an other. And as she gathered around the idea that she individually cared about, she was able to also find those people who cared about it too. And then with that new context, it gave her that belief and space for that idea to grow. And then, you know, the us ended up shifting the thing into action. And so as she acted on her purpose, she ended up finding her people. As she found her people, she also activated her own power. And this turns out to be really instructive, right? So a lot of the stuff that's talked about on the internet, which I find really funny, people say there's a new power or that this democratizes access. And I find it super interesting that they're not actually pointing out what the key shift is. It's not that power is different. Kimberly had the same capacity before and then after. Nothing changed with her. What has changed is context. And I find that incredibly instructive and important, because if you can then go find your people, which is what the internet has actually really enabled, you can find the people who then can see you and see your idea for what it is instead of having to hide it. They can stop negating you. They can celebrate your onlyness, and then you guys can join together in this way that turns out to be really powerful. But it's not about you changing. It's about the context changing and figuring out how to be in that context. And of course, I come at all of this from an innovation background. The reason all this matters is, of course, it lets someone like Kim have dignity and Kai have dignity, and all the 10,000 girls at Kimberly's program of Black Girls Code has changed since its inception. It also can unlock a whole set of problems that we have yet to tap into. We're consistently tapping into the same set of ideas because we really only listen to the same set of voices. And recently, The Economist ran this article. I said we run out of ideas and that the cost of innovation has gone up. And I was looking at it going, actually, no, you have not come close to running out of ideas. What you have come close to is running out of ideas from white men. And if you could find a way to tap into the rest of us, then it has really positive consequences personally, economically, and certainly for innovation. And I'll share one piece of research that I think brings this home, and then we can do Q&A. The one piece of research I'm especially in love with is, and it's one of many that I found, is that Kareem Lakhani was at Harvard University and figured out that there was, you know, his basic theory was we could open up more innovation if we opened up problem sets. And he had this set of research done, 166 scientific problems from research laboratories of 26 firms, and that had been unsolvable. And he opened them up to a global group. It was essentially citizen scientists, not just trained officials, sort of, you know, through a set group, and said, you know, can anyone kind of help us solve these problems? And over 80,000 people participated in this. And one third of the problems that were previously unsolvable got completely solved. So that's new solutions to, you know, old problems, right? That's the piece. So it's like things like progress on things like Alzheimer's and ALS was made during this thing. So what was most interesting, and to bring this point home, is that of that group of 80,000 independent people who came and solved those one-third of the problems, they did research to say, okay, well, who were those people and what did they look like and, you know, where did they come from and so on. And it turns out that nearly 100%, and I'm not exaggerating, nearly 100% of those new, brand new solutions that were completely unsolved before came from people that they called from left field. And, you know, again, they're using a relative term instead of what you and I might now use now that we have the word onlyness between us. So they were using the relative term of left field, and they were uncredentialed or young and old, but most of them were women, people who in the scientific field typically get screened out and unheard and seen by the silhouette of who they are rather than the soul of their ideas and what they can actually bring. And so that's why I think this idea really can unlock a new capacity. We can say to ourselves, certainly one step is to say to ourselves, how do we stop banging our head against walls when the context in which we're in is actually the group of people who basically don't want to see us. It doesn't serve them to see us because it would mean we would have a voice. And some people don't want us to have a voice consciously or unconsciously. And the second is that we can actually allow us in humanity to find the kinds of answers and creativity and solutions that we all need, whether it's to solve things like cancer or to enable wider education access or, well, whatever it is, because we can imagine, because there's a boundless set of ideas that we each have that are right now being limited. But in a world of onlyness, I think can be unlocked. And so that's really why I care so much about this idea and why that reframing of that word is so important.
Great. Okay. Well, I have a couple of follow-up questions for you. First, can you say a bit more about the mechanism of finding your people? What's step one?
So I don't want to pass this too fast. So I do want to say, first, you have to know what it is you care about. So, I'm saying that because I think a lot of us can, because we're not being heard, think, oh, it must not be that important. So what is it you distinctly see or believe is possible? Because without you, there is no us. So first, you just have to start with, okay, this is the thing I claim as what I care about, right? So back when I was doing, when I was in my mother's household and I wanted an education, what ended up happening a few days later turns out to be revealing to the story of how do you find those with whom you belong. I ended up showing up on campus. First of all, I couch surfed for a few days, and then I showed up on campus and told the dean of admissions, who I happen to know, about what was going on. And he, as it turns out, believed in this idea of education for all, regardless of gender, as strongly as I did. And he walked me around campus and helped me get jobs. So, you know, Friday, accounting job at the History Museum on campus, a ushering job that I could do on Saturday nights and so on, so that I could, and then he actually walked me to the bursar's office so I could, you know, get loaned $500, which I actually was like, no, don't loan me any money. I'm not good for it, because I'd never had that kind of cash before. And but he was like, no, you can do this. And so I had a community of people as soon as I claimed that thing I cared about. So there's this interesting thing that starts to happen, that as you first signal to yourself what you care about, you end up surfacing those other people. And then the way mechanistically any of us can do that, we can be online and posting blogs. We can, you know, so that we can say, oh gosh, you know, what's a good example? So in fact, several years ago, I would not have considered my feminist probably, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And because I didn't even understand what the word meant, I didn't even understand what it looked like or what the trade-offs were. I just wasn't well-read in this field. And so I kind of knew women were underseen and underserved, but I wouldn't have then said also I was a feminist. But at one point there was some article, who was the woman? She used to write for Inc. magazine. I can get her face, but now I'm going to like block out her name. I've been traveling a lot, so my jet lag is probably kicking in. But anyway, she had written a piece for, I don't know, TechCrunch. And in this piece she had said, basically the reason women do not succeed in business is because they have children and they really need to be parents first. And I was like, what the heck? And you know, here's a single anecdote then arguing as to why women should not be leaders. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And so I had written an essay on my blog, which at the time, not that many people read, but it was really just me sitting on a couch in my pajamas writing about, here's why I think that argument's wrong. Here's a different argument. And I didn't think anyone was going to read it. You know what? It's like, here's the thing, but I'm expressing, right? I'm claiming that thing I cared about. And then some person online said, oh, I really found this article interesting. We should talk. And that person ended up being an organizer of a group called Change the Ratio, which was a group of 500 women all committed to changing the ratio of women in boardrooms and on stages and as entrepreneurs. And so because I was signaling, right, using that language, someone else was also seeking, okay, who else is interested in the same thing of being this vital group that could actually gather together and build an informal network of people who could start to help one another accomplish that goal. So choosing those to whom you belong, it starts with you claiming and signaling. And of course, you can do it in other ways. You can go to meetups. You can go to conferences like the Conference for Women in all these different locations, and you can basically start to talk about what it is you care about, and then in that context, find the other people who care about the exact same thing as you, as specifically as it needs to be, right? Not just that we care about women and equity, but we want to figure out how to do fair pay or whatever the specific is.
It's so interesting that you frame it that way. My next question was going to be about sort of real world signaling. It may be an urban legend out in Silicon Valley where you're based, but there are more than a handful of people out there who are not super comfortable with technology, and they are not going to be blogging on their couch or, you know, even necessarily commenting on articles. Or what do you recommend in that case?
I really struggle with that one because I think if you're not willing to raise your hand to your own idea, it's hard for other people to see that, you know, to see that that's what you care about. That's a tough one. I have friends who are, very similar, like, you know, really would not want to be the writer online because then they think they're going to get critiqued or whatever. And I say, okay, so maybe it's about what is the local community with you already belong. And so is there a group, you know, that a friend you already know living near you that would care? I know a bunch of people that right post the 2016 election gathered together in small groups to talk about what did this mean? What did this election mean for me and for us as a citizenry? And I know so many of these groups, and mostly women, but I'm sure there's other types, then gathering together and actually sharing. How do we build citizenship? How do we build trust in each other? How do we, and they've been doing that since 2016. And so it can also be local, right? So I think meetups and all those kinds of technology pieces are key. But in the case of my example with the community college, it was literally me finding the other person in the context. But it did involve me saying, here's, you know, signaling really what I care about. And I think that's the one part that is the onus that is yours, because it is you claiming your own life force and that expression of who you are that has to be yours to carry. And then other people, of course, will join you in that work.
Now, how does this work on a micro level? Can you be signaling like-minded seekers in a tiny community such as, you know, your office?
Sure. So if it's a team, let's say, in fact, I just had a person who was a UX designer, so her responsibility is actually to shape how the product's experience is. And she was hired to basically reinvent how the company would do that and actually have a more user-friendly experience. And yet she found most of the conversation she had with her mostly male colleagues, they, you know, she wasn't using her experience set. So they had a completely different perspective, but they were sort of negating hers. And she came to me and said, what could I do? And I said, well, is there anyone else in the company, whether it's the customer service person or the salesperson, or, you know, are there other people in the company who might care about the same thing as you do for having a great customer experience? And she said, yes. And I said, okay, why don't you gather a lunchtime audience of people together, and maybe you bring in a few other people, just, you know, local people who are in the community who do great design, and hold a series of salons inside the company, you know, small luncheon gathering pizza kind of moment, to have a conversation about how could we do our customer experience of this product better. And you will start to build a coalition around the idea. That's what's really important here, is it's not been around you and your role, but around an idea. And it doesn't matter what role you have then. It starts to shift how we organize, how we mobilize one another. And that can be a way in which you start to build that group of people who gets you. And that will give you strength of your own idea, and that could also help you build that kind of group of people to then figure out, okay, who do we need to influence so we get to where we need to be as a company?
Great. That's a great idea. Well, we're going to have to end there. I'd like to remind listeners that this teleclass will be posted to the conference websites as a podcast. So if you want to listen again or share with a friend, keep an eye out for an email from Eventbrite letting you know when that's ready. You can learn more about Nilufer Merchant and sign up for her newsletter at nilufermerchant.com. She also has a great, regularly updated blog there. Nilufer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.